I'm Julia Sherbakov, and this is Impact Journey. Conversations with hidden heroes making big societal change.
This is the culture at NASA, and it's a white man, white scientist culture, thinking only about production, not only about excellence in science at all costs, even to the cost of running over people and making them feel disposable. So the most difficult part of my job is to change the culture.
Today, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Rita Sambruna from NASA. About her impact, Rita is an astrophysicist and deputy director of astrophysics at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, where she leads efforts to improve diversity in her division and in her profession. This conversation feels so relevant now at a time when we're talking about space in the context of how we invest in our shared future, and at a time when diversity and inclusion and people are top of mind. About her journey, we hear how a culture of excellence at a place like NASA can yield some amazing results, but can also come at the expense of people. So Rita is working to shift the focus on culture and shift what we mean by excellence, to put at the forefront people, especially people who are excluded. And the reason she's able to do this comes from a big part of her journey, her humanitarian focus, along with her inquiry into our place in the universe. So please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Rita Sambruna. I would really love to hear your original inspirations that have gotten you to this point, especially because you had many interests when you were younger, interests in our society and how it works and the oppression of people in our society. And so I'm curious how you finally did become an astrophysicist and how those interests, what they might have in common. What were the driving forces for you in those early years that eventually led you into this path?
So discovery has always been at the forefront of my mind. Discovery, curiosity. I was always asking, how does this work? Or do we have evidence of this or not? I was driving my family crazy because I was asking why for everything, including religion, right? I still remember one of my grand aunts, me asking, how do we know that God exists? And she was saying, well, because the priest says it, because the Bible says it. Yes, but how do we know? What proof do we have? So curiosity and a sense of discovery always drew me. And also a parallel track to this was always a humanitarian interest. When I was a child, I tried to set up a group to go bring company to elderly people. In elementary school, I tried to recruit my classmates and say, well, we can do some good, you know, we can bring some food and we can sit down with them and talk and feel their day. I had a very precocious sense of justice. I've always been upset when I heard of people being mistreated, of women not having the same opportunity, of Black people being, I grew up in the 70s, so back then it was the apartheid, right, in South Africa. And so that really made me very, very, very upset. And I was always wondering, what can I do to help? And so these two parallel tracks, right, discovery eventually went into science and physics and astrophysics, because the universe is the biggest lab out there. And the other parallel track is the humanitarian view, how to help people, how to make a difference in the world. And then eventually they converged now in my present job because I'm in charge of hiring. I'm the deputy director. So together with the director, I'm in charge of the division. And I'm trying to change the way we hire, trying to diversify the workforce, trying to bring up different voices and give a podium to those who have been traditionally excluded from astrophysics and from NASA.
Those two tracks of your life, so the discovery and the curiosity, but also the sense of justice and inclusion, it seems like they probably would have merged
even earlier in your life, because to state the obvious, as a female in a very, very male dominated field, I imagine you had to fight a bit of that fight throughout your career.
Yes, I always had to stand up for myself, and I learned it gradually. I was raised not to have confidence in myself because of the Italian environment. And then when I went to university, I had mainly male colleagues, but I also had a professor who I admired a lot. And she was a female. She was traveling the world. She had a family, but she also had a career. And that was a big inspiration. And it was her, actually, who sent me here to the US. During my PhD schools, she sent me here to a colleague of hers, another extraordinary woman, and I learned everything that I know from the two of them. Right now, we are going towards 30% females in this profession, at least in the US. So things are getting better because people have been doing things to make them better. Mm-hmm. Now we need to do the same thing with other underrepresented groups. And that's what I'm trying to do.
And it's so interesting to hear the examples that you had in these mentors, because I imagine that without them, that would have been so much more difficult. And actually, I wonder if you would have been where you are today without them, and not just without them pushing you and making the connection, but without just even seeing the example of like, oh, it is possible for someone who kind of looks like me to do this in this field and to achieve. I'm really also drawing the parallel to a lot of the work you're doing now with diversity and inclusion, of why it's so important specifically in NASA to have a diverse field, partly to have more minds working on these important discoveries that we want to be making, but also because NASA specifically is such a visible example to people coming up.
Absolutely. NASA is a brand that is recognized everywhere. I went 8 years ago on a trip to Africa in Uganda, and in a small village in the mountain, they knew what NASA was.
Oh, wow.
So it's a recognized brand everywhere. And so you have touched on a very important point here, which is representation and representation at the top. So if I didn't have the example of my two colleagues who mentored me and nurtured me, I would not know that it is possible for somebody like me to have a career at NASA, to rise in the ranks, to take supervisory positions, to be in charge of 300 people. And so this is exactly what we need to do for more inclusion and more diversity. The biggest problem that we have right now, even to get students, PhDs, early career scientists to even apply to NASA, is that they think that they don't belong to NASA. Why should I waste my time sending in an application? They don't want me. I don't belong there. So this is the culture that I'm trying to change. And in order to do that, we really need to break the wall, start bringing in scientists, representative of various communities, different races, different genders, different gender orientations, different religious orientations, different walks of life. So representation is really, really fundamental here, as is changing the culture in order to retain people. The most insidious problem that we have right now is microaggressions. Those very small, day-to-day, almost imperceptible things that sum up at the end of the day to be discouraging for the person. So the way they get looks, the kind of questions that they get. And it is very insidious because people don't realize it. It's a white culture made for white people and white men in particular. And so we are all growing up with that mentality, and it's so difficult to change.
And in this case, the mission of the astrophysics division at NASA, a mission to figure out how our universe works and why we're here. But it's such a wide mission. And yet within that mission, there's so many questions to ask. And it also matters who is asking those questions. Given that you work at NASA, it's not related to your division, but in the last few weeks, a few white male billionaires going into space and a lot of money and a lot of resources going towards that and a lot of blowback from that also of we've got a lot of problems to work on. And is that really one of them? And so it really has me thinking of what is the diversity of perspectives when those decisions are being made of what are we even going to focus on?
Yes, exactly. Diversity of thought comes from different experiences in life, from different cultures. And that allows you to look at the problem in a different way. And that's where innovation comes from. And it's funny that you mentioned the rich people going up recently in space, because just this morning I was on Facebook and I saw this humorous quote, maybe UFO are billionaires from other planets. It made me laugh.
Oh, that's a good one. I haven't heard that, but
on one side, I am all for enterprise and discovering. If you have the means to do it, by all means, just do it. Open a door for the rest of humanity. They are showing that this is possible. It is true that all that money could go to fix other problems, but you know, humans are also much more than just eating, sleeping, and working. We also need inspiration in our life. And I have talked to many people who find these first steps towards space travel very inspiring. It makes them think that it's possible to reach for the star, literally and figuratively. So I have mixed feelings, but as a scientist, I'm happy.
That's interesting. Yeah. Going back to your work in astrophysics, what's so interesting is the astrophysics program, it plans in decades. Planning in decades is so counter to how we often plan, certainly in the business world. I'm just curious how working on projects that have that scope, how that affects how you see the other part of the things that you're really passionate about, our daily problems in the world right now that you're also involved in. How does that shift your perspective? How do you take that long-term perspective from one to the really day-to-day issues on the other hand?
That's a very interesting question. And yes, there are day-to-day problems that you need to approach and to solve. But without knowledge that there is an ultimate goal, I would not have the motivation, I would not have the support that I need to solve the day-to-day problems. So I don't know if everybody is familiar with this, but every 10 years, the astrophysics community comes together and sets the priorities in astrophysics for the next 10 years. It's also to make recommendations for the state of the profession. So in the last few years, I have not set priorities just for the missions that NASA, but they are also starting to look at the well-being of the people who are doing that work, recognizing that science is done by human beings. If the human being is not valued, supported, and included, if there is no diversity of thought, then the path forward may end prematurely. My impression is that the state of the profession will tell us that there is a lot of work to do, especially for including people of color. There are very few people of color in astrophysics and in physics. And as I look at my division, only 1 or 2% of my scientists are people of color. This is not acceptable. Even though this is a reflection of the field is not acceptable. And so we need to do so much more work. I want to point out that it's not just race, but it's also, for example, people from rural community versus people from urban community. It's important to involve both.
And what's hard, as you were saying, working towards those goals related to diversity and inclusion. And I think a lot of companies, a lot of organizations in a lot of fields find this is it becomes a pipeline problem. You know, you look further up the pipeline and you're like, well, I'm just recruiting who's graduating. What do you want me to do? And it's a different set of activities that needs to happen to actually potentially shift who's going into the sciences in general and in physics in particular and astrophysics. I'm just really curious, what power does NASA have to go all the way upstream, up the pipeline?
We don't go upstream because NASA is not an academic institution. But I refuse the premise that we cannot do anything because of a pipeline issue. We cannot just say it's the academia problem, let them fix the problem, and then we will come in. Because we need to be proactive, go out and recruit people who already are in the system, make them feel valued, make them feel included, and set them up as an example that, yes, you can do it. Somebody who looks like me can be part of NASA.
It connected the dots for me, what you were saying about retention and culture at NASA and microaggressions and the sense of belonging, because it's not just, okay, well, we need to recruit more people, let's just look for them. But it's actually, it's whole systems and ways that things had been done before might need to change. And so I'm curious for you, what are some of those ways that things have been done that you could potentially eventually see changing? I imagine it's partly policies, partly approaches, partly language. I just wonder which of those parts do you see as important?
And so they are all important, but what you just said, changing the language, changing the policies is the easy part. The difficult part and the most important part is changing the culture. And by culture, I mean the culture of excellence at all costs that is so pervasive at NASA, and excellence at all cost to the cost of the human being, looking at people as disposable, just there to do a job. And if they don't do it well, let's just brush them off and there be somebody else that we can hire to do it. Or requiring 24/7, all week of the year, work intensive effort without work-life balance. So this seems to be the culture at NASA. This is the culture at NASA. And it's a white man, white scientist culture, thinking only about production, not only about excellence in science at all costs, even to the cost of running over people and making them feel disposable. So I had a lot of conversations with some of my scientists who have exactly that complaint. You know, the management is only looking at the production line. They don't care if we are not feeling included, if we are not feeling heard. So the most difficult part of my job is to change the culture. For example, one thing that I am profoundly convinced of is that we need to start looking at people holistically, not just by their technical qualifications. Because in that case, we always end up with people who are brilliant scientists, but poor teammates, poor leaders. What I'm trying to change is the way that we do the evaluations of candidates. We are trying to do a holistic hire. Look at their experiences with life, look at their skills, look at their soft skills. And so that's the type of people that I want to have in my division, with technical skills, but also a perspective on life, perspective on people who have a humanitarian side to them. At the end of the day, people come to work only if they're happy. And they're not happy if the culture is excellence at all cost and no, you don't fit the mold, you're out.
And what I love about what you're doing is you're really shifting what excellence means. This is when we're talking about language, right? Is redefining
excellence to take into account the human dimension.
No, that's such a good point about culture and the almost invisible elements of culture that are so pervasive that really connects to one of the things you really started with about wanting to work with the elderly and providing company for them. I just really see this theme in your approach about accompanying, protecting, advancing, I don't even know what the right word is.
Championing,
thank you. Championing groups that are maybe unseen or less prominent in our common vision and our common narrative. What I find really interesting about that, reading a bit more about you, is you do that with animals.
We are all connected, Julia. We are all part of the same continuum. What hurts you hurts me. What hurts that animal hurts all of us. I firmly believe in deep connection. I'm not very religious, but I am spiritual in the sense that I feel very strongly a connection with the universe, because I know that I suffer when I see animals or people mistreated or excluded. I know that I suffer when I see injustice in the world and in my field. And maybe sounds selfish, but I really do think that we are all connected. It's one life force flowing into all of us, but united by this invisible thread. So breaking one piece of this thread is just breaking the thread, basically. Mm.
Oh, and that's so interesting. I hadn't thought about how also your knowledge of the universe comes into that, of the common force or forces.
That's exactly right, because everything started with the stars that exploded and sent elements out into the universe. And these elements became you, me, animals, plants, rocks. So we are all made of the same stuff. We are all children of the stars. We are all made of star stuff. And that should be the unifying theme in the world, I think.
One of the reasons I was so interested to speak to you, working with space, with astrophysics, you have such a longer view, both in terms of distance and in terms of time, and this ability to zoom out and to zoom out both at our society and at our world, right? But also zoom out at our time in the grander sense of time, puts some things in perspective, I imagine.
You feel when you're contemplating the universe and the inner workings of the universe, you know, how stars are born, how galaxies are born, you feel so small. You feel small, but you also feel big because humans are able to make sense of what's out there. There is something connects us and makes us feel part of this universe all together. And to me, that's social justice. We are all looking up at the same moon. We are all looking up at the same stars.
It's very poetic to hear you say that. So I appreciate that. I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for your time, for your experience, for bringing your passion for both of these tracks of your life to this conversation.
Thank you, Julia.
A big thanks to Dr. Rita Sambruna. You can follow her work in the links in the show notes. This is Impact Journey. See you next time.